Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart, and this is All of It. Last week, Prince's estate re-released his seminal album, 1999. The album re-release is one of many posthumous releases from Prince's catalog. Most of them have been songs and albums, but today we're talking about something else, a book. The Beautiful Ones is written by Prince and edited by Dan Pippenbring. It's named after a song from Prince's album, Purple Rain. Pippenbring describes the song as one of the most naked, aching songs in the artist's catalog. When Prince picked Pippenbring, who was an editor at the Paris Review, to co-write his memoir, it was a surprising choice. Prince had been presented with a long list of candidates, which included some high-profile names, and narrowed it down to just two people. All they had in common, apparently, was that neither one of them had ever written a book. Prince and Pippenbring eventually met in person, and Prince's confidence in the young writer's potential was evidently confirmed. In meetings and phone calls, they talked about Prince's grand plans for writing a book that was better than his first album, one that would break the mold of the memoir and even solve racism. But just a few months after the two of them met, Prince was found dead at Paisley Park, his private estate. The cause would later be determined as an accidental drug overdose after taking Vicodin laced with fentanyl. He died without a will. When Prince died, Pippenbring only had an early draft of a few of the chapters for the memoir, but he understood that Prince wanted this collaborative project to be completed and for his work to get out. The final version of the book includes those chapters, drafts, as well as an essay from Pippenbring, a photo book Prince had begun in 1977, and a handwritten synopsis of an early version of the film Purple Rain. Pippenbring writes at the end of his introduction, "These pages represent only a sliver of what could have been, but I hope it makes good on the mission he set out for us to provide, quote, a handbook for the brilliant community, wrapped in autobiography, wrapped in biography." Dan Pippenbring, welcome to All of It.
Thank you, Jenna. Happy to be here.
That is quite a mouthful, an ambitious goal to meet for a book. A handbook for the brilliant community, wrapped in autobiography, wrapped in biography.
Yes.
First, can you just sort of unravel what that means? Because it's a mouthful to say.
It is, yeah. I mean, one of the great pleasures of working with Prince and just talking with him was seeing his ideas evolve minute to minute, sometimes second to second, and just kind of sitting and experiencing his ambition in its rawest form. And I think statements like that are the best proof of that. I think anyone could have written a kind of salacious tell-all memoir. Certainly someone like Prince has enough stories to fill one. Mm-hmm. But he did not want to do that. He wanted the book emphatically to accomplish more than mere storytelling. It had to have an inspirational component, and I think it had to resonate with this kind of budding activism that he was undertaking at the time. He was a huge proponent of Black Lives Matter. He had written a song called Baltimore to celebrate Freddie Gray and to protest the police murder of him. And I think he saw that a book, as opposed to music, had capabilities that would allow him to expand on that message and in addition to telling stories from his life, that he could move people, that he could get them to think twice about how the music industry works, about how it exploits Black artists, about...
Which all seemed to be themes that we saw sort of play out in real time during the course of his life.
Exactly, yeah. And I think there was just so much excitement when we would talk about what the book could be, because he was so original in how he approached everything. And I think here, too, in addition to his albums, he saw a way to do things that no one had ever done before.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about your relationship with Prince pre-meeting him.
Yeah.
So first, when and how were you first introduced to his music?
It was really fairly late. I didn't grow up listening to him at all. and I shake my finger at my mother for that sometimes. but I remember going to a Walmart in 1999, of all years, and seeing what was then his latest album, Rave Unto the Joy Fantastic. And he was going by the unpronounceable symbol at that time. Mm-hmm. He's wearing a kind of blue vinyl or pleather outfit on it. And it was really unlike any other record for sale at that Walmart. And I remember handling it and being almost afraid of it. Like, who is this guy? And that was the first time I can remember really reckoning with him. But I didn't buy it. And I didn't really hear his music, to my knowledge, until a few years later when I heard the song If I Was Your Girlfriend on the radio in Baltimore, where I grew up.
Well, before we get into a little bit about the significance of If I Was Your Girlfriend, mm-hmm. for our listeners, who yeah. probably haven't heard it, can we just play a quick clip of If I Was Your Girlfriend from Prince?
If I was your girlfriend, would you remember? Tell me all the things you forgot when I was your man. Hey, hey, when I was your man.
If I was your man. That song, which I've always thought was so not only powerful, but was just so daring for the time when it was written.
Yeah.
So much of Prince's music seems like he could have just written the autobiography just with lyrics alone.
Exactly, yeah. And I think his writing style is very lyrical. He has that concision and that economy that you expect from a great songwriter. And in that song, I remember hearing it and just the amount of space in it, the propulsion of the drums, even though it's a drum machine. Mm-hmm. I'm a drummer, and I at that time was very against drum machines in the way that only a teenage boy probably can be. But I remember being like, wow, that's really funky, but it's also so eerie and ethereal. And then on top of it is this voice that isn't just a falsetto, but a sped up or pitched up falsetto. So a man's voice taken to a very feminine place, singing about the desire to be not just someone's lover, but her best friend, to find a love or an intimacy that transcends all boundaries, really. And I think explores the way that sometimes love can sometimes come at the expense of friendship. And I'd never heard a message like that in a love song. It was so daring, as you say, and so haunting and so moving. And I immediately felt that I had to know more about whoever was making this song.
Well, in your desire to know more, you eventually got this gig. Can you tell me a little bit about how you even came to be the co-writer of Prince's memoirs?
Yes, yeah. So I had a literary agent who was always wanting me to write a book. And fortunately, I never did that because it turned out Prince wanted someone who had never written a book. But he met up with me one night and kind of let it slip that one of his colleagues was working with Prince on what at that time was just going to be a book of lyrics with annotations. But they knew that Prince would need some sort of collaborator. And my agent knew that I adored Prince. And I said, well, I would love to help. And he said, okay, but this thing, you know, this fact that you've never written a book before is probably not going to be such a great resume item for you.
Wow.
Yeah. He was being honest. And I mean, I understand most people, when they're looking for a collaborator, they want someone with chops, with experience, someone who can guide them through the sometimes protracted process of writing a book. I couldn't do that. I'd never gone through it myself. And it turned out that when Prince got this list of names, as you said, he crossed off all of them except those of us who had never written a book before. He had a great proclivity for young people, and he always went out of his way to mentor them and to work with them, to nurture them. And especially at that point in those final years of his life, I think he'd really grown into this elder statesman role. And his last band, Third Eye Girl, was three young women. And mm-hmm. I think this was just a continuation of that practice.
Well, tell me about your first introduction to Prince, first meeting him, first time going to Paisley Park.
Yeah, that happened in January of 2016, and I had written this personal statement on the merits of which Prince had flown me out to Paisley. I expected him to be surrounded by minders and keepers and aides, maybe someone fanning him with palm fronds, feeding him grapes. and to his enormous credit, he met with me one-on-one, and I think that's a sign of the autonomy that he had demanded for himself at that phase in his career. So I met him in the foyer of Paisley Park. He shook my hand. I remember how quiet it was. I could hear doves cooing. There were candles lit everywhere.
No, not doves.
Live doves, yeah. He kept them in a cage. On one of his albums, they're actually credited because you can hear them cooing. He recorded it there, and they made their way onto the tape. So, yeah, they're real, and they're still there. And we talked in his conference room for about 90 minutes, and he made me read him that statement, which... Mm-hmm. was in itself kind of surprising. I hadn't thought to even bring a copy, so I had to read it from my cell phone, and he really abhorred cell phones. So I felt like we were off on a pretty... we were off to a rocky start. But it got even worse because he stopped me after the first sentence, which was about that song. I said, when I listen to Prince, I feel like I'm breaking the law. And he was like, whoa, 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 let me stop you right there. He felt
well,
that
Prince says stop, you should stop.
And I did, yeah. I went no further. He explained that he really felt that he lived in harmony, that he wrote music that was in accordance with certain ideas of harmony that came from his spirituality, and that really I had it wrong if I felt that his music was in any way law-breaking. And I learned very quickly that I had kind of addressed that statement to the Prince of 1987, who released that song, rather than the Prince of 2016, who had different ambitions and different priorities.
I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with Dan Pipenberg, editor of The Beautiful Ones. Can I do it one more time? Sorry. I'm Jenna Flanagan. I'm filling in for Allison Stewart. I'm Jenna Flanagan. I'm filling in for Allison Stewart. I'm speaking with Dan Pipenbring, editor of The Beautiful Ones. So when you had that moment where Prince was like, no, my music is not, I'm not a lawbreaker, that's one of the things that I found so interesting about this, is that Prince had this need to sort of walk this line between mystery and relatability, being magical and yet human. How did you work that out?
It was tough. And I think a lot of it came through in his fastidiousness with language. He was a very meticulous man when it came to the words he chose and which ones he wanted in his orbit. And one of them that he resisted most of all was magical, actually. He had a real disdain for that word. He felt that funk is the opposite of magic, that funk is about rules. It's this earthy thing driven by labor. And I think he, in a way, had been so effective at evolving this mystery around him that he felt a bit hemmed in by it. People would treat him as if he were an extraterrestrial beamed down to our planet, and he wanted to say, no, I'm a human being. I came from a specific time and a specific place. I have these two parents who made me who I am, and I got to this position by working very diligently and very creatively. So a word like magical, he felt, had no place for him at that time anyway. And another one he resisted was transfigure. I wrote that he had transfigured popular music, and he made me look that word up on my phone and read the dictionary definition aloud. And of course, it has a religious signification that he resisted. He didn't want something, a word so holy, affiliated with his secular work. And alchemical was another one. I could go on and on. So I think he was really trying to portray himself as someone who came of age in Minneapolis, who owed so much to his father, a very disciplined figure, and his mother, a very spontaneous figure, and that he was living almost as the two of them combined in one body, and that he had worked and worked until he had his craft down and he had this persona. It was not something that was an act of sleight of hand or anything. It was creative, and it was labor.
You know, speaking of Prince's parents, of course, they are a very integral part of the work that he's done. We, of course, so many of us are familiar with the pop song When Doves Cry. Mm-hmm. And again, for the few people who might not be familiar with it, we can play a quick clip right now.
Alone in a world that's so cold.
What's so interesting about this book is you mentioned that Prince envisioned this book as focusing on his mother, something that he wanted to be dedicated even to mm-hmm. his mother. And yet, at one point before passing away, you write that he wrote that at 12 years of age, he left his mom to go live with his father. And it was, quote, the happiest day of my life. I needed to be my own hero, mm-hmm. unquote. How did that complicated relationship, first of all, how much of it were you able to even be able to grab a hold of, to be able to even write about?
It was tricky. I think we were really only scratching the surface, that there could be something almost Freudian or psychoanalytic about our conversation sometimes, because he really was so focused on his parents. And he himself, I think, was still working out their presence in his life. A few days before he died, he told me that his life's central dilemma had been trying to square their impact, that he was still thinking that his father and his father's work ethic had helped make him who he was. But if he was out at a fancy dinner party and the DJ put on something funky, he was going to get up and dance no matter what the decorum would suggest he should do. So I think in a very real moment-to-moment way in his lived experience, he felt a kind of internal quarrel between them. And it's surprising to me that he said those things about wanting to live with his father and everything. And really, in the pages he wrote, celebrates his mother only, I think, in the earliest moments, his first memories of her eyes and this kind of mischief that she was able to endow their conversations with just by winking at him. And of course, you see that in almost everything he does. Prince had such a lively sense of play. That mischief is really there. And even in conversation, it would come out in his own eyes. If he could give a side eye or kind of squint at you in such a hilarious and knowing and deadpan way. And I, looking back on it, I can't help but see his mother in those looks. So I think it was something that he was still teasing out, and we were kind of working through it together, but we had only just scratched the surface.
Well, I do want to sort of go back to a more central question, at least for me, and that is, do you know why Prince chose you? I mean, you sort of touched on it in the sense that he liked to mentor young people, that he was looking for someone who hadn't read a book, but here was also this project that he was thinking could perhaps solve racism. You're a Caucasian male, and that seems like that's a huge order for anybody to do, but for the two of you to collaborate and do that, do you have any idea why you became the person?
It's still very much shrouded in mystery. And there was a point in our first conversation at Paisley where he said, I'll be honest with you, I don't think you could write the book because you haven't experienced racism. And that was so central to the project. And I really, as much as that disappointed me, I fully understood. And I didn't really expect to get the job in some ways for that very reason. It didn't seem like I could go to the places that he wanted to take the book to. And I think if it turned around at all, that it was a similar moment in that first conversation where I asked him why he wanted to sign a contract with a big publisher like Random House, given his aversion to such contracts in the music industry and his feeling that he and all artists, but especially black artists, had been exploited by the lawyerly and legalistic means of the record industry. Because it seemed to me that all of their tricks had really evolved out of a model of intellectual property that started with books well before there were even phonographs, you know? In the 19th century, when people were first signing contracts and putting books out and everything, or even earlier than that, that was the beginning of the trend that resulted in these exploitative practices. And I think he really wasn't expecting me to question him on that front. And I remember him saying, well, I can picture myself writing. You might be wondering why I'm working with Dan. And it's because of something like that. So I think if I won him over in any way, it was by challenging him on certain decisions he was making or not accepting everything he said at face value. But that's still very speculative on my part. I really, I don't know why. I can remember him snickering at one point and saying, people are going to wonder why it's you. And he was almost delighting in imagining conversations a lot like the one we're having right now, where he's like, no one's going to know why.
Oh, well, I'm sure. Dan Pipenbring, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Dan Pipenbring is the editor of Prince's memoir, The Beautiful Ones. I'm Jenna Flanagan, filling in for Allison Stewart. Stay with us for hour two of All of It.